Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by Tim Miller, our colleague Tim Miller. Tim, I get more requests for when you can have Tim Miller back on, because Tim Miller is our favorite guest. So this is by popular demand.
Oh, I'm blushing, Charlie. I'm blushing here.
So anyway, if people haven't signed up for your Snapchat thing, this is very cool because a lot of what we do is for the olds. Please don't write me about that. But Tim has a weekly show on Snapchat, which so I think your median audience age is probably a little bit younger than the median age for this podcast. I'm
just a couple decades younger, I think, on the Snapchat show.
Okay, don't dig it too far.
I had a Snapchat employee message me and said that they were listening to our episode where you first mentioned this a couple weeks ago. They said, "I'm just living for hearing you explain Snapshot to Charlie Sykes on the Bulwark Podcast." So they're amusing it. It's great. It's called Not My Party. You just download the app, you just swipe left and search for Not My Party. It might seem intimidating, but it's doable, and it's only 3 minutes every week. And I'm hoping to this week give some hot analysis about the electoral impact of the SCOTUS pick, which we can talk about a little bit here, but it'll have a lot more funny sort of memes and repartee on Snapchat. You can show it to your teen. It's a win for everybody.
And it hasn't been shut down by the federal government yet, right? Nope. And this is not one of those things that Donald Trump has decided to shut down yet. We are not quite there. Okay, I want to get to the takes on the Supreme Court. We have some developments as you and I are beginning this podcast. Mitt Romney, deep sigh, is siding with Mitch McConnell in moving ahead with this. So that's pretty much a done deal. If there was any question about whether or not they were going to vote this year on the nomination, I think that's pretty much a done deal. You probably got a sense of that when Lamar Alexander rolled over. And then we heard from Cory Gardner, who basically threw himself off the parapet. He's not even going through the motion. So we did an emergency podcast on Saturday, and I know you listened to that and you had different thoughts. You wanted to
say,
Hold it because I had a couple of things I have to do first.
Okay.
Because you are a professional ad maker. You are the guy. Okay. You do this. I know there are more important things to talk about. I mean, I know we're hitting 200,000 coronavirus deaths. The president is out there saying it affects no one. Okay. So there's that. We're getting a lot of, obviously, the Supreme Court nomination. We're getting closer to the debates. We're only 42 days out. I get all this. I am obsessed with this ad down in Georgia from Senator Kelly Loeffler, who is running for reelection. She's got a more conservative challenger, and she's decided that she needs to run going full out Donald Trump. And she's in a very, very tough race. And this is the ad that she just put up where she's decided that she's going to compare herself to Attila the Hun, because apparently this is a primary. Who is the most reactionary person on the ballot or something? So Kelly Loeffler's ad.
Did you know Kelly Loeffler is ranked the most conservative senator in America?
Yep, she's more conservative than Attila the Hun.
Fight China. Got it. Attack big government.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Eliminate the liberal scribes.
More conservative than Attila the Hun.
Uh-oh.
Kelly Loeffler, 100% Trump voting record.
I'm Kelly Loeffler. I approve this message.
Okay, so Tim,
I just don't know. I love podcasts, but I just don't know if like the majesty of this medium really fully captured it, because you have to see D-list. I mean, really like X-list version of like the Geico caveman that they cast as Attila the Hun, who like looked like it was like out of a Wayne's World infomercial from 1983. I felt like that was really what captured it from an ad maker's perspective.
Okay, I get that it's probably supposed to be funny. And as I wrote in my newsletter, I said it's got that certain "this is so bad, it's a parody of itself" vibe. But I guess my main takeaway was just the pure dumbness of the thing. I mean, how stupid she must think her voters are dumb. I mean, this really does tell you what Loeffler thinks that the voters want in the Trump era. This pitch that's both sort of, you know, kind of creepy, funny, but dim-witted and crude. And she might not be wrong, but she's doing pretty well in the polls.
Yeah, well, This, you hit right on it, Charlie. Like, the serious take on this is that it shows where the party is. And, you know, our friend Jonathan V. Last has been all over this. And, like, a lot of the kind of craziness of the Trump era is top down, because he's such a unique, crazy figure, which I guess is the understatement of the day. But a big portion of it is driven bottom up, right? Like, this is what the people want. Like, you know, they're just out there playing the hits. And, you know, what the voters want is a candidate who's going to demonstrate they're going to be the meanest one to the media. And I guess if the right way to do that is to make a really bad joke about, and it seems like it's a murder joke, right? I mean, I guess isn't that what Attila the Hun would have done? Murdered, yeah, the media? Right. Yeah. So I guess it's a ha-ha, not really very funny joke about murdering the media. You know, I mean, that is what the voters are looking for. They're not – see, look, if in 2000
– triggers the libs, LOL.
Exactly. In our day, Charlie, in my golden day as a young man, back in my day in the aughts, you know, okay, this isn't a new thing, right? You want to be the most conservative person in the primary. But in our candidates, it'd be like 100% record with the pro-life, like, right, like Club for Growth, endorsed, you know, Garrett, you know, committed to cutting spending, a rating from the NRA, you know, say what you want about all those things, but like, they were policy oriented.
They were words. They were sentences. Yeah. They conveyed actual ideas.
Right.
Even a bad, see, this is the thing, is it has gotten to the sort of a just like grunting, scribes. It's lowest common. So I get your point about, you know, top up, bottom up, but it also is top down, because we didn't used to have ads like this, really. And I think part of it is that the way that Donald Trump has made the conservative movement and the Republican Party dumber, meaner, crueler, and it's I mean, look, it's I refer to it as the adultification of the GOP, and you have all of these copycats and clones. What I've noticed, I'm slightly obsessed about this as well, is watching commentators, and not just on social media, who I've watched for years, and watch how their language becomes cruder, simpler. And by that simple, I don't mean to praise them for clarity here, but how they really have become more Trumpified in their language. And part of it, it's like they're not trying to persuade anymore. It's just sort of like this Mad Libs of just kind of throwing out random memes. And maybe it's a reflection of our politics. Nobody thinks that we can persuade anyone anymore. So why bother just sort of do these bumper sticker bleats?
Yeah, the idiocracy, you know, the descent idiocracy. I mean, just look at the Texas senators' social media accounts, you know, for a good example of that. And Cruz and Cornyn. I mean, maybe Cornyn was never that serious of a guy, but, you know, Cruz, like, initially pitched himself as this kind of constitutional conservative, right? Like, very serious.
Deep thoughts. And, I mean, intelligent, yeah, from Harvard. Did I mention that? Did I mention I'm from Harvard? But no,
and their Twitter feed now is just, it's literally grunts and, like, you know, embarrassingly bad faith, like, attempts to dunk on the libs. You're right. I mean, certainly Trump has kind of ushered this in. But again, it's because it works. Well, it's working with the base that it's spreading, right?
This is what we've wanted all along. You were giving us policy papers. Now we want just trigger the libs, LOL. Liberal scribes. Okay, so we're going to get to Supreme Court in a moment, but I want to talk about somebody you've been working with directly. You know, Olivia Troy.
Yeah,
I'm not misstating that, right? Because
no, you're not.
Okay, you put together the video of her. So Olivia Troy is this remarkable woman, and growing, you know, the latest of a growing list of people from the Trump administration, high level Trump administration officials, who are now coming out and saying this is what we saw, and it was really terrible. And she was a top security aide for Mike Pence. What was her actual title? Do you remember?
She was his advisor for Homeland Security,
big deal. And so we had Miles Taylor, we had Elizabeth Newman, who's come out. By the way, H.R. McMaster goes on 60 Minutes and talks about what a danger the president is, and hardly makes a ripple. I mean, we're at the stage where there is this pattern. But Olivia Troy came out last week, and you had an ad from Republican Voters Against Trump that was very, very powerful. And I hope people just bear with me for a moment, because she was she gave an interview to NBC, and this was this morning. This is the story about her that was aired by NBC. Let's play Olivia Troy.
Olivia Troy is a lifelong Republican who worked at the Pentagon, was detailed to Iraq, and worked at the National Counterterrorism Center. Most recently, she was an advisor to Vice President Pence. But after 8 months on the coronavirus task force, she says she had to speak out, calling it the hardest decision of her life.
I felt that in my heart and in my entire being, I think American lives were continuing to be on the line.
For months, Olivia Troy had a front row seat to critical decision making inside the White House, seeing firsthand what outside critics have said about the president's handling of the pandemic.
He was really focused on public image, messaging, and it was really more about, you know, his personal agenda than really the agenda that the task force had at hand, which was, how are we going to save and protect Americans?
She says President Trump knew in January how serious a threat the virus posed.
We certainly had a task force meeting and discussion where we had this conversation that this was going to be big.
That early, January 28th.
Late January, we knew.
Yet the president was saying a week later, it's going to disappear. It's going to go away.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
How did that make you feel?
It was frightening. You know, when you're the president, words matter.
At one meeting in the Situation Room, she says the president suggested COVID might not be such a bad thing.
Did the president of the United States really say that?
Absolutely. I was sitting to the right of him in the room when he said it. And he was like, and you know, when you're a politician, you have to shake a lot of hands. You have to shake a lot of hands. And these people are disgusting. It's gross. And so maybe COVID's probably a good thing, right? I don't have to shake hands. I don't have to do that anymore.
He said that maybe COVID's a good thing because he doesn't have to shake hands with people, with disgusting people.
That's what he said. And I can't imagine how any honestly normal human being would ever say that out loud in the middle of a pandemic.
She describes the scientists' frustration over the president not wearing a mask and promoting hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine. Right now, yeah.
What was the breaking point? What made you want to speak out?
I felt like I needed to tell the truth about what was happening and what we were dealing with internally, especially with the president, who, you know, was very intermining of all the work that was going on in the task force. I just felt that now it mattered more than ever.
Both the president and the vice president dismissing her account.
It reads to me like one more disgruntled employee.
I never met her, to the best of my knowledge. Maybe she was in her room. I have no idea who she is.
Troy says that she still respects the vice president, but thinks he was in an impossible situation. Never before in politics, she is endorsing Joe Biden, a decision made even more important after the CDC once again reversed that important guidance on the virus only just yesterday.
And speaking of yesterday, of course, the president who told Bob Woodward that he'd always wanted to downplay the coronavirus, this is yesterday. Keep in mind that either yesterday or today, we crossed that mile marker of 200,000 American deaths. And this occurs just at the time that we may get the fall surge. But on the day that we pass 200,000 deaths, this is what the president of the United States said. This is from the rally yesterday.
Now we know it affects elderly people with heart problems and other problems. If they have other problems, that's what it really affects. That's it. You know, in some states, thousands of people, nobody young, below the age of 18, like nobody. They have a strong immune system. Who knows? You take your hat off to the young, because they have a hell of an immune system. But it affects Virtually nobody. It's an amazing thing. By the way, open your schools. Everybody, open your schools.
It affects virtually nobody. Tim Miller. Oh, yeah. Tim.
Yeah, the other thing that happened yesterday, by the way, is we passed the United Kingdom in per capita deaths, which you know, gives us essentially, besides Spain, the worst response in the Western world now. I mean, some of the South American countries have had worse, that have obviously far fewer resources to deal with something like this. So,
that's a devastating quote, though. It affects virtually nobody. That strikes me as the kind of thing that is going to be up there right with, no, I don't take any responsibility for this.
I mean, I guess it would be a more devastating quote if it was just like not the same thing he says every day. Look, in that first rally in Tulsa, he was talking about how it's just the sniffles. And, you know, then Herman Cain dies. How can you just, I mean, how many more of these can you add to the pile? I mean, it's clear what he's trying to do. And this is what Olivia is testifying to. And I mean, obviously I'm biased here since we were working with her, but I want to underscore this, like, this is not an easy thing for her to do. And, you know, I think that she gets criticized, you know, there are people that are criticizing, that are out there saying like, oh, this is, you know, good for your career. And, you know, now you can get in with the libs and they can all give you jobs and the media will be nice to you. And, I guess the media is nicer to people who tell the truth than people who lie to them all the time. But, you know, this is not a situation like John Bolton, where she's selling a book and refusing to actually endorse Joe Biden, or a situation like, you know, the Mooch, who's like trying to, you know, be a multi-platform star. Like, she's just a normal person with a normal job at a trade association. And you know, people at trade, you know, they don't really love it when you're on the nightly news. Right.
She's not really at a 40s. Trade association. She's got a long way to go.
She's got a long career. Right. You know, who knows who wins this next election? You know, she had job offers to do political work in the White House. So this is, you know, you have to put yourself out there. Obviously, you have friends and family who are supportive, but also some who are for the president and, you know, kind of think you betrayed him. And so, you know, this is tough. And I think it's so powerful because you can see how tough it is for her, but that she just feels compelled to tell the truth. I mean, in the video, she talks about how, you know, she'd go home and it's like, how can I look myself in the mirror and think I'm making a difference when anything that we do to try to help is being undermined every day by the president? And so, you know, I think this is why, when you say that H.R. McMaster doesn't make a ripple, like, we are getting a little inured to, you know, important person around the president doesn't like him, like, no shit, you know? Right. And so I think that it can break through when you see this is somebody who, this is like literally her dream job. I mean, this is somebody who wanted to go into the government to be able to help protect the country. Like, that was why she did this. And she feels like she can't protect the country because the president is such a clown. And so, hopefully that will, you know, have an impact with some of these people who keep getting, you know, who don't like him, but keep getting sucked back in and don't really trust the messengers of the media, or, you know, these kind of people who look like they're trying to be famous TV pundits.
Okay. So speaking of people, and we're not pivoting here, of people who are being sucked back in, we've talked in the past about the anti-Trumpers, people who have recognized many of the downsides of the president, been appalled by his behavior, his crudity, his lies, his narcissism, his corruption, everything. But when it comes down to it, the Democrats are always worse. But you can tell that there was a real ambivalence there. And now that we have an open Supreme Court seat and Donald Trump is poised at the 5-yard line to be able to put the third conservative justice on that court, solidifying conservative control of the U.S. Supreme Court for a generation, you can tell this is what they've been looking for. This is what's going to bring them home, right? So I want to get your take, because you wrote a great piece on Sunday and you've listened to the other takes we've had on this podcast. What did we get wrong? What's going on?
Yeah, look, I think that that is right, Charlie, among kind of the pundit class, right? Yeah. Like, and I think that there's a certain class of voter for whom this sort of reminds them what they like about Trump, right? They've been reminded they've been reminded a lot this year what they don't like about Trump. This is the, you know, kind of 15% of his of the people who voted for him last time that said they had an unfavorable view of him, that don't like the tweets, et cetera, et cetera. But here's my thing, Charlie. I think that those people were coming back to him anyway. Right? Like anybody that says that this is the final straw for them was already going to vote for him. I mean, Christian Schneider, I think you mentioned this in the podcast with Amanda yesterday. His article is right. It's like once they jam this through, it's sort of, you know, another way to look at this for those people is like, well, what more do I need from this guy? Like, I already, you know, I made my deal with the devil. I got it. And now we can dump him. But that's not their mindset, right? Because they always were coming back around to Trump. The thing I think that you guys have missed in the podcast over the last 2 days is that there's another group of Trump voter that is, you know, when people hear about kind of the famous diner Trump voters, the famous Obama Trump voter, they, in their mind, a lot of times they think about the person that's going to the rally, the person that was out of the political system, and then Trump came along and they put on a red hat and like they're super fans, and those people exist. But there's another Obama Trump voter, and it's just this kind of blue collar working class guy in places like Wisconsin who is pro-choice, who's for Obamacare, who's for protecting entitlements, but who is not for globalization and immigration, and they hated the Clintons, you know? Right. And so that's why they came around on Trump, but they've been Democrats their whole life. I don't know, Charlie, 6 weeks of hearing about how Trump is going to put some far-right Notre Dame Catholic, you know, pro-life absolutist who's going to get rid of Obamacare on the court. I think some of those people might peel off, and not a ton, you know what I mean? Not a ton, but if you look at the electorate last time, he won over about, I'm going from memory, I think it's 8%. I might have to get corrected on that. I think it's 8% of the electorate was Obama Trump voters. You know, if 10% of those say, I can't, this is just too far for me. I didn't want Ted Cruz. Like this is why I was a Democrat in the first place, because I hated people like Ted Cruz. I thought they were weirdos. Like Trump to me is a guy I saw was a business guy who probably paid for a couple of abortions in his life, right? Like that's the Trump that they were buying on to. So he could lose some of those folks in addition to the point I think you made rightly in both pods, which is sort of exciting the more traditional Democratic base. To me, it's just a loser across the board for him from the election standpoint. Obviously, there's court and a lot of other factors at play.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to work through this because the real danger, I think, for the Democrats is that the left will overplay its attacks on, let's say that's Amy Coney Barrett for the moment, because I think it's more likely than not, unless he, you know, does the Florida play, but attacking her Catholicism or Christianity, there's a long tradition of backlash to that. But the people who will be most offended about that were already going to vote for Trump and were already motivated to vote for Trump. So I do think that that's a danger, but it's probably a wash. The Democrats, if they focus, and I noticed this for at least 24, 48 hours, we're pounding away on the healthcare issue that the court, it seems very, very likely now to throw out the entire Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, including the protections for pre-existing conditions. And I don't know, was it Biden who made the point or so? Who made the point saying, you know, anybody that's got coronavirus, that is now a pre-existing condition? I thought that was actually a pretty good pivot. That's the kind of thing that I think can, you know, get people's attention. You know, there are a lot of pro-life voters out there, but you're probably, you know, more up to speed on this than I am. What are the numbers on repealing Roe versus Wade? What percentage of the electorate wants the court to throw Roe versus Wade out?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of one of those things where it depends on how you ask the question, right? You know, look, I mean, you know, putting Roe v. Wade in the garbage is a minority position. Like whether that's kind of 60% or 70%, you know, sort of depending on how the question is asked. I mean, sure, yeah, there are pro-life positions that are winning positions, right? I mean, third trimester abortions are winning positions. I mean, they're winning ways to make the pro-life argument, sure, and the country is actually moving more that direction. But just completely overturning Roe v. Wade is not popular. And you know, again, the people who are passionate about overturning Roe v. Wade are pretty much already with him. Like there is a small sliver of, you know, the McMullen voter last time who is a single issue pro-life voter, who I guess potentially he could win back. But I'm telling you, Charlie, that's a much smaller part of the electorate than the pro-choice voter who's for Trump. I mean, I forget where I think it was Nate Silver, one of these guys had it. 15%, if you look at the crosstabs of Trump's voters last time, said they were pro-choice, right? So like Trump, it's not as if Trump, doesn't have any downside risks here.
I think the other downside risk, which you touched on, which is I think the most dramatic aspect of this story that I've seen, and I mentioned this on the podcast yesterday with Amanda Carpenter. I think this story about the money that Act Blue, the Democratic Political Action Committee, is raising. This is just staggering. So, I mean, within like the first hour, they raised, a few million dollars. When the first 3 days, they'd raised $100 million. Last I looked this morning, they're saying that they raised, since Friday night, and this Tuesday morning right now, $120 million. I mean, that's FU money. I mean, you can say that maybe money is, I've made the case that maybe money's, overvalued in politics, but, you'd rather have the $120 million than not. The money is just flowing into the coffers of these Republican Senate candidates. Might Democrat. Not get them over that. I'm sorry. Yeah. The Democrat candidates, you could see Lindsey Graham is in a real dogfight, and he was on Fox last night. And I don't know if you caught this, but he's asking for money. I mean, he had that look like, guys, they're coming for me, and the money is just pouring in here. So leaving the money aside for a moment, what that just tells me is just this the base has been activated. And always in an election like this, the question is, okay, Biden is leading Trump among young voters by 30, 40 points, whatever. But are young voters going to do what young voters always do, which is not vote? This is the kind of thing that is going to pull some of those progressive non-voters to the polls, because we've been obsessing about the Trumpian, those non-college educated whites from northwestern Wisconsin who didn't vote in 2016. Would they now, these non-voters, would they suddenly become voters for Donald Trump? And maybe there will be. But I think it's time to ask the question about whether that's happening on the left in bigger numbers. So...
For sure. And I mean, like I said, I kind of agreed with Bill Kristol's column in The Bulwark about this. Like, if they jam this, especially if you're at a 51-49 vote, and we got to talk about Mitt a little bit, I guess, but, 2 weeks before the election,
yes,
it's going to overturn Obamacare, potentially overturn Roe v. Wade, at least in the minds of the voters, like whether or not that the votes are actually there. That's just a loser for Donald Trump. It doesn't mean he's going to lose the election, but it just doesn't. This notion that it might help because there's some small sliver of anti-Trumpers that'll go back to him. Like, yeah, that's true, but it's just overwhelmed. And if you look at the Senate, Charlie, like Cory Gardner and Martha McSally are committing seppuku for this seat. And that, maybe that's their choice. And maybe they think they'll get paid off on the back end as a lobbyist or isn't, I don't know how many more seats Martha McSally could get appointed to after losing multiple times, but
ambassador.
Yeah. Maybe they think they get something on the back end for this, but like, it is bizarre that they aren't even faking it. I mean, this is like how weird our politics has gotten, that, party loyalty and loyalty to Donald Trump is now so great that there are literally senators who just have given up on trying to win their election. I mean, they're not even going to pretend, they're not even doing the old shtick of like, well, I'm going to analyze the record of the candidate. I mean, both of them are out there saying they'll vote for whoever Donald Trump puts up in purple states. Colorado is basically a blue state now, and Cory Gardner is the last statewide Republican official. And then you got Iowa. I mean, the poll, the Credible Seltzer poll this weekend came out showing Joni Ernst down. Georgia, two seats up in Georgia. I mean, I don't want to, get the Democratic liberal listeners too excited here, but like, I mean, there's a real possibility of just a Senate bloodbath, and that's where the money does matter, I guess, more than at the presidential level.
You mentioned the scene of pushing this through 51-49 2 weeks before the election. It could be the week before the election. I mean, it's the timeline on this is crazy fast, because you're talking about if he nominates somebody on Saturday, you got what, 39 days until the election, 39 days to go through the entire process. There's no way they can do that without looking like it's a rush job. The optics are going to be bad. Now, there might be bad progressive optics if there's too much hysteria. I mean, I know I'm going to get all the blowback on all of this, but you can overplay the hand as well. But
there are other things they can do, though. I mean, there's still a coronavirus bill.
Oh yeah,
you know, well, like what they're going to not pass. They're not going to do a second relief passage to jam this through. Like that's another loser. I mean, there are. Well, not to undermine the difference of the court, right? But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of political losers here.
That is a great talking point, that the Senate cannot get around to doing the coronavirus relief legislation, but it can find the time to ram through this. So that's going to be bad, certainly bad for the Senate. Okay, so we have to do this. We have to talk about Mitt Romney, who... I think a lot of people had been thinking over the weekend. I certainly was one of them that was, you know, counting up votes who might want to actually not ram this through before the election. And you thought Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Mitt Romney, and then who would be number four? But we're not even going to get to three because Mitt Romney says he's going along with it. What's up?
Yeah, I kind of had the sense that he was going to. I mean, look, Mitt, to his credit, has done his best during his time. He's not been perfect, but he's done his best to try to assess each situation based on the facts, right? And not get sucked into, oh, I'm a Republican, so I have to do this, or oh, I hate Trump, so I have to do that. And that makes people unhappy at times. And when you look at this situation narrowly, and this is, I wrote about this weekend, for the Bulwark Plus, sign up for the Bulwark Plus.
Yes, please.
If you look at this narrowly, it's true, right? Like narrowly, stated, like the president nominates, the Senate has time to advise and consent, the Republicans have the Senate. Historically, when that happens, doesn't happen very often. Maybe it was 1880 or whatever, but you know, when one party has the presidency in the Senate, like the judge goes through it. That's just what the letter of the law is. And so if you look at this through that lens narrowly, you can see why Mitt lands here, and why he says in his statement, you know, while fairness matter, what does he actually say? He says, this is not a result of a subjective test of fairness, which is in the eye of the beholder. A little bit of a cheeky statement there on that, because my argument to Mitt would be that the perception of fairness does matter. And because of what happened with Garland just 4 years ago, this distinction that, oh, because the Senate is a different party versus the Senate being held by the same party as the president means that precedent is different. I mean, you know, that's a pretty absurd and silly distinction, frankly, if you made the case that it was about being an election year in the past. And so, you know, what I would have done if I was Mitt is get rid of that kind of silly precedent distinction and just say that, look, he's, you know, a senator and he's going to advise and consent on judges as they come up and come down. The problem, though, Charlie, is that there's a real, I think, reason, justifiable reason for the Democrats and Democratic voters to believe that they've been treated unfairly, because they have, right? And so the result of that is going to be this continually spiraling, you know, push by both sides to take as much as they can without having any regard for how much they should and what should be done for the benefit of our kind of body politic. And Mitt seemed to kind of disregard that. Which I think, frankly, is kind of in line with what he's been doing and sort of where I expected him to land, which will probably disappoint some of his new friends on the left.
Well, this is a hard issue once you get past the procedural fairness issue, a hard issue for Republican senators to stand up against the president when it comes to a conservative Supreme Court judge. And the test that I've always had is that, you know, would they vote for this candidate if a President Jeb Bush or George Bush had named this person, or Ronald Reagan had named this person? And I think when you have somebody like Amy Coney Barrett, you can easily imagine that she would be appointed by some other Republican and that there would be no opposition among Republicans. But I do think that I just want to throw this out being a little bit contrarian, because I know that Jamie Weinstein, who does his own podcast, had an interesting tweet. last night about this, saying, look, you know, this is going to be dueling grievances here, and it will escalate, just like you said. And Democrats are really, you know, have real complaints about the way that Merrick Garland was treated, about the nuclear option for the Supreme Court. All legitimate things to mention, and the way this is going to be ran through. But remember that Republicans also have their list of things what they think were incredibly unfair. What happened to Robert Bork, the Clarence Thomas hearing, whatever you think of the merits, you know, among Republicans, they think that, you know, these were their grievances, that their guys were treated unfairly. The filibustering of Miguel Estrada for the D.C. Circuit Court, remember, you know, accusing Alito of being a bigot, you know, which actually caused his wife to cry, the filibustering of Alito, and then, you know, Harry Reid, who really set off a lot of this by ending the filibuster for other judicial nominees other than the Supreme Court. And of course, the Kavanaugh hearing, where still a lot of raw feelings about some of those allegations, which against Brett Kavanaugh, which we know are not true. Now, there may have been some that were true, but there were some that were just, you know, should never have been aired, including all the Michael Avenatti bullshit and everything. So, you know, but both sides are stocking up with their grievances. They're going to be locked and loaded going into this and then going into early next year.
So my response to that, Charlie, is, well, first, for those listeners out there that are just clamoring for more Tim, I did do 2 hours on the Jamie Weinstein podcast. So, you know, you can just get into a bubble bath and just, you know, listen to my dulcet tones for as long as you want, if you want to, you know, click over there after this. Here's my problem with what Jamie wrote, is that it seemed to me like comparing these lists of grievances, where it's like somebody came and robbed your house. And then, like, you know, when the police came, they say, well, you know, but that guy said something mean to my wife 2 weeks ago. And, like, I mean, you know, like his kid egged my house last Halloween. It's like, yeah, I mean, all the things on Jamie's list were fair. Many of the things on Jamie's list were fair grievances that Republicans had with the Democrats, but not on the list was stealing a Supreme Court seat. Honestly, I mean, and that's what this is. I mean, you could argue that it wasn't stealing a Supreme Court seat if you were holding this norm of election year appointees don't get, you know, don't get advised upon, but literally 4 years later, you're breaking that norm. And so It's impossible to look at that as anything else other than the theft of a Supreme Court.
Well, I think about the Merrick Garland theft.
I don't think this one is. No,
no, no, this one's not, because this is, look at me, he's the president until January.
Right, correct. Yeah.
Okay.
The Merrick Garland thing was a theft though. And so anyway, so if you don't mind, this is what I wrote about this weekend. And
I wanted
so,
to get, you know, yeah, the 21 year old.
Yeah, so I'm writing a Sunday emergency newsletter for Bulwark Plus subscribers. Please subscribe, $10 a month. Not, you know, you can do it. I'm going to write it as long as I feel like we're in a national emergency, which may be until death. I don't know.
Forever. We'll see.
But you know, the point I was trying to make in this was looking at our Democratic Republic through an eye of a 21-year-old. And somebody that was born in 1999. What they see is George W. Bush, the first president that they, you know, during their life, was elected by a minority vote. The only president that they know who's been twice elected by a majority vote was denied his ability to appoint a Supreme Court nominee based on some, you know, kind of what seems to them like political bullshit, frankly, some like arcana, you know, not really a credible reason to be denied a Supreme Court seat. Then the president they know best, who, you know, who when they were in high school, you know, came to the presidency again based on a minority vote with the help of a foreign enemy, encouraged that help, has absolutely no regard for any political norms or the rule of law, was impeached for trying to get help from a foreign country again to hurt, you know, his Democratic opponent, and then appointed a Supreme Court justice in the exact same way the only president that they see as fully legitimate was denied from doing just 4 years before. Like, this is when they've come of age in politics. And so, yeah, you know, look, I'm sure there are 60s kids who got disillusioned that that saw certain things like this before. It's not, this isn't unprecedented, but when you look at this, you can understand this lack of trust. And when you add into that, you know, the you know, disproportionate, you know, rural bias of the Senate, when you add into that, you see things like Nate Silver say that Joe Biden needs to win by 5 points to be guaranteed an Electoral College victory. It's easy for them to look at this and say, I get that we're a republic or whatever, but like, you know, this doesn't seem very fair. This doesn't seem very democratic. And this seems like something that we need to change. And so I think that the reality is, if we are not responsive to that, I think very legitimate concern, even if everything that was done was technically by the letter of the law, if it feels illegitimate and it feels unfair to a mass, you know, to a broad enough part of the body politic, they're going to demand change. And if we can't demand change within the systems, within the structures, within a fair way, like we've done in the past in a lot of different things, the Senate used to be appointed, by the way, you know, this isn't a constitutional crisis. Every time we make a change to make things more democratic, make things more fair, if we don't do it in a fair way, they're going to do it in an unfair way. And we're going to go down this drain of both parties just not really caring about our norms and our laws at all, and just trying to own each other. And I'm concerned that this vote will help continue to escalate that that spiral.
Well, yeah, and you point out, I mean, this is the question, is how long can you have minority rule? Every once in a while, there might be some sort of a moment where people are willing, they may not be happy about it, but they're willing to tolerate it. But if that minority rule becomes really onerous, if there's a lot of triumphalism, if it becomes the tyranny of the minority, that's the problem. One of your lines from the newsletter I thought was really sort of hit me, said, you know, pretty much every person this 21-year-old knows is looking for a job in one of the dynamically, largely democratic cities where all the growth is in this country. But most of those enclaves have minimal national political power and their vote is irrelevant. So you have this entire generation and they are told over and over and over again that, frankly, yeah, you don't really count that much. You're not going to have any count. You're not going to have any clout here. You're not going to be able to elect the people you want. And you're watching how your irrelevancy leads to this you know, non-representative Senate, a president who may lose by 5 million votes. And at some point, that is going to have a corrosive effect on support for our democratic republican constitution. I mean, that's inevitable, right?
It's
not sustainable.
Yeah, and especially when the people that win based on minority vote don't act like it. I mean, right? And I remember when I was growing up, there was this thing called a mandate that we used to talk about, right? Where if you won by a lot, you had an electoral mandate to do a lot.
And
if you won,
if
you won narrowly, then the mandate was not as great and you would like work with the other party. I mean, you know, Donald Trump got fewer votes than 3 million fewer votes. And he governed like he won a Reagan landslide. Right. And so did Mitch. And so, you know, I think that big fans of Cocaine Mitch listening to this podcast might think, hell yeah, good for him. Get what's yours. You never know what's coming back. But this, you know, that is part of this. Like, that arose is when they look at this and they're living, and like I said, think of these cities. They're living in Chicago, New York, Houston, Dallas, Denver, Atlanta. I mean, not like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle. Like, look at the cities where Amazon was going to build their company, Washington, D.C. I mean, some of these cities, they literally don't have representation in Washington, D.C. None of those people, unless Georgia flips, are in a state that has any influence on this race. And so, like, yeah, when they see that, they feel like, you know, the Electoral College, maybe it's a fluke. Once in a while, we have to represent all these smaller states. But if it's this continual drip, 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 and then the minority government that wins, you know, puts their boot in their face.
Well, and that goes
that's going to have an impact.
That goes back to the triggering the libs LOL, where if our politics is about, you know, doing things that humiliate and anger the other side, that just takes that, you know, and ramps it up. Because, you know, it's one thing to be a gracious winner or a gracious loser. There are no gracious winners and losers right now, at least in the style of government that we are seeing. Okay, two stories that I'm kind of a little bit, I've already admitted that I'm obsessed about the Kelly Loeffler thing. Since I use that word so often, maybe I'm just going to be obsessed about everything through the election. This new Andrew Weissman book about the failures of the Mueller investigation, I just want to, you know, put a pin in it that I think this is one of the most significant books of our era. And he was one of the top aides to Bob Mueller. And he documents all the ways in which basically they blew it. They were intimidated. They were bullied. They backed off. They didn't subpoena people like Ivanka and Don Jr. When there was tremendous pushback from Trump after they went after some of his financial documents. They basically said, we're not going to go after the president's finances at all. I think this book really does explain how Trump stared down that investigation, but also why he believes that he can get away with anything. It's also, I think, the first draft of history that we now are starting to get a sense of how historians are going to look back on this as, you know, in answering the question, how did Donald Trump behave this way without any consequences other than possibly losing re-election? And the Mueller investigation is going to be remembered as a botch job. I just think that's the problem. But here's something I want to ask you about. This story out of Pennsylvania, where apparently there's a possibility of 100,000.
Just really quick on Wiseman.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
I don't really have a deep thought on this, I do want to steal David Frum sucks. It was, you know, I get such little joy amidst our plague and fires, Charlie, that when I get some joy, I do like to share it.
Yeah.
Frum wrote, if curiosity killed the cat, then any cat owned by Robert Mueller can look forward to a long, full life. which I appreciated. The financial part of that is just I just think that there's going to be hopefully there will be a long period of revelation about Donald Trump's finances after it was too late to do anything about it.
Yeah, I sort of fantasize about these histories in the future going, well, this was going on. Voters didn't learn of this until after this because of these various reasons. Okay, so the Pennsylvania thing, the simple story is that Republicans of the state Supreme Court are basically taking the position that if a voter does not put their otherwise legitimate ballot into a so-called secret sleeve inside the envelope, am I getting this right, that the ballot is thrown out. So you may have 100,000 otherwise valid votes thrown out because of this sleeve. They're called naked ballots. If your ballot is naked, they won't count it. Boy, you want to talk about the nightmare scenario of this election coming down to Pennsylvania. And then the question of, do you count those 100,000 votes or do you not count those 100,000 votes? And that goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you watch Fox News, you can tell that they're as anxious to have a Supreme Court justice to hear those election cases as they are on Roe versus Wade at the moment.
Yeah, I forget who I was talking to about this. One of the, you know, kind of good government groups was on a conference call, and the general mail-in ballot vote counting is, I think, a much bigger concern than some of the things that you hear a lot about. I think that Trump's attempts to, you know, whatever, stay into next year. And so, you know, some of this stuff I think is a little overwrought, but I do think there's a practical concern about vote counting in mail ballots. Things like if they didn't sign it in the right place, you know, this Pennsylvania situation is extremely outrageous. Not putting it in the envelope. How does a judge rule on that? Here's where the Supreme Court stuff comes into play. You know, we're getting to a hanging Chad situation. I think that, the Democrats would be wise to invest a lot of the money that they are getting in this Act Blue effort into just straight PSA campaigns about how to fill out mail ballots, because I think that I'm hopeful but concerned that I will be back here on this podcast in December analyzing mail ballot counting procedures, and I think that is a— well, you can't say anything's a worst case scenario anymore, because anytime you think it's a worst case scenario, something worse happens. But it's a very bad case scenario.
So you and I could have had a podcast last week where let's play the game, Tim. What's the worst case scenario? We would have come up with, well, what if this happens? What if this happens? Okay, then there's a delay. And then at the end of it, so that's the worst case scenario, right? And then somebody would have said, well, what if Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies? I'm sort of laughing. I mean, it's like
just the Cobb laughter. Yeah.
Just when you think it can't be, you know, on your bingo card, what's the, what is the next worst thing that could happen?
Or like a month ago when it was like, well, you're stuck inside in California because of the plague. What's the worst thing that can happen? How about 3 weeks of fires to keep you to go from going outside as well? So you can't be outside or inside.
And then maybe we'll have a hurricane thrown in there, and there's always something else. But so on that bright and cheery note, with just 6 weeks to go, I mean, isn't that kind of mind-boggling to you that 6 weeks from today is Election Day?
I'm ready.
So we are all ready.
I feel like I've aged 100 years. I look at videos from myself from in the Snapchat show. Final plug, not my party. I had to put up an old clip of myself being wrong from 2016, and I was like, I look like I'm 19 years old in this video. I feel like I'm aging like the lady at the end of Titanic over the last 4 years. So I'm ready.
Well, Tim, here's the bad news: is that gets worse.
Oh no, Charlie! Please.
As you get older, because you'll notice that. And then you know what's going to happen. You're going to have a podcast someday, and people will say, well, you know, unlike old people like you, Tim, those of us that are on, what will be the version of Snapchat then?
TikTok Plus.
It'll
TikTok
be an
US.
Yeah, that's right. It'll be an implant in your brain. Remember when you olds, Tim, would actually watch things on a phone? You know, so this... there's a certain cosmic justice. Tim Miller, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Election Day is just 6 weeks from today.